This is fun! The FU Network!
Hey, Canada, welcome to episode 9 of Matter of Fact. I'm Ishat Reza.
And I'm Professor S. Let's get started.
So we're talking about election rules today. As you know, we have an election coming up shortly. The writ hasn't dropped yet, which means we aren't officially in the election period, but it's going to be any day now. It has to be by September 15th, 2019. So I thought it'd be good to have a chat about the election rules. And with me today, I have lawyer Stephen Lawtons. Welcome, Stephen.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Great. So as I mentioned, you know, the election is coming up. It's going to happen by October 21st. And the rules that were set to make the period of an election be predetermined requires that a minimum campaign length of 36 days is necessary and a maximum of 50 days, and that the election has to happen by the third Monday of October in the fourth calendar year following the previous general election, which in this case means October 21st, 2019. At the time that we're recording this, the writ has not yet dropped. Any predictions on your part, Stephen, when that's happening?
Oh, when the writ drops? Yeah, well, it'll certainly obviously be this week. I think Thursday's a lucky day.
Thursday, okay. We'll see. I think I'll go with because today is Tuesday as we're recording this. So I'll go with Friday just to be different, and let's see if either of us are right.
Okay.
Maybe you can start us off with a little bit of info about some of the new rules, because some election rules have changed. Since the last election.
Yeah, well, since the last election, the Liberals introduced Bill C-76, which did a couple of major overhauls and a few new timely rules to what happens in election period. And it's added important things like advertising rules, third parties, foreign influence, social media rules. And also it creates what's called a pre-election period now. Which is to regulate the term up to a fixed election. So
that's right. And actually, I think that started June 30th.
That's right. It started June 30th. Yeah. And what it does, it sets rules and puts limits on parties and third party groups on what they can spend and what kind of activities they can engage in, what kind of political activities they can engage in the pre-election period, because before this it was pretty much unregulated. You didn't know who was paying for what. You know, in this age of sort of big money and fake you know, grassroots groups, you know, the AstroTurf groups like Ontario Proud and now Canada Proud, where you only found out after the Ontario election, you know, who was part of Ontario Proud, and it turned out to be a bunch of developers, but alleged to be wanting to get their hands on the green belt for development. But at the time, during the run up, it was billed as and widely believed to be this spontaneous grassroots organization that grew out of people who were just unhappy with the Wynn Liberals. And it turns out it wasn't. It was a lobby group of land developers. So it's to prevent that sort of thing from happening. It requires people to register. If you're going to spend more than $500 in the pre-writ period as a third party group, and you also have to identify your donors, and you have to, if you're spending more than a certain amount of money, you have to actually get a financial advisor who will an agent who will actually issue reports. You have to basically report and ID yourself, and it includes, and we heard this, it came in the news a little while ago, that there was concern that issue reporting, which is covered under the new Canada Elections Act, introduced in Bill C-76, that if you are doing issue reporting, then you also have to register once you spend more than $500. So an issue
report, and that's where that whole question about, well, if you're against
climate change,
or if you're in favor of climate change, then that's seen as a partisan activity or something like that, right? That was
absolutely. That was one of the third party things. You know, if it was partisan activity, which was promoting one party or an issue that's associated uniquely with a party, then it was considered partisan activity, and that would be issue campaigning. So that's now covered in the
pre-auction
period.
As long as you're spending, but it only kicks in, like those rules would kick in if you spend over $500.
Which that's right.
Your average person, like you and I, say tweeting about it, we don't spend any money doing that, right?
No, so, no, and we're
so
not.
We wouldn't be captured. Yeah,
yeah, we're not a third party. We're just citizens exercising our right. But as soon as you start spending money and taking out ads,
exactly,
or doing polls, or doing push polls, where you're doing a poll but you're actually pushing people in the direction of your point of view or your candidate, then those are the activities that are mm-hmm. covered by it. And I know I on both sides. So there was all that hoo-ha about the. People who are doing the climate change and whether or not that was an election issue, because it was identified with Bernier's People's Party as their hot button issue on the other side of it. And Elections Canada said, that's really not what this is meant to cover, sort of broad public policy issues. You know, if you had one party that was pro-free trade and one that was anti-free trade, and you came out as an anti-free trade organization, then that would be considered partisan, because you're clearly identifying yourself with an issue that is identified solely with one party. But when you have the broad issues like climate change, Elections Canada has said that's really not what we are, what we think is going to be covered by this. And part of this is the interpretation, because this is brand new. Everyone's kind of feeling their way in the dark. So you have to really rely on a little bit of common sense, not mm-hmm. just the wording of the legislation and, you know, the occasional pronouncement from Elections Canada, which took a couple of days to come out in the case of the climate change issue, where they just said, you know, no, this isn't what we had in
yeah.
mind.
I think the takeaway, though, for most of us is, you know, if you're just a citizen who's tweeting or commenting or whatever, and you're not spending money, or even organizations that aren't spending money to comment, this doesn't affect them, right? But if you are an organization that's spending more than $500 on issues that are being captured within the election, then it might be worth them getting some kind of advice, legal advice, on whether they're then captured and whether they need to adhere to certain rules, right?
Like that's
that,
right.
I think, is the best way to go forward.
Yep, that's right. And not and this isn't the for third parties. This is generally, you know, there is a pre-election, if we're talking about the pre-election period, there is now a spending limit on pre-election ads. And you know, that's it's a little over $2 million. I think it's $2.05 million.
Yeah, that's for parties.
That's for parties. That's right. That doesn't cover a third party. That is party
spending. Third parties.
Spending.
I did look at some numbers here. So it's like $1.02 million throughout the entire period.
I think it's half of that $2.05 million. I think they just arbitrarily picked that number.
But interestingly, there the third parties can only spend up to $10,000 per riding.
That's right.
Which I thought was actually a really good way of making sure that they're not just sort of concentrating things in one area.
So they don't dump it all in a leader's riding or in some other, you know, if they really want to get rid of a particular cabinet minister, you know, you can't plump it all down in one place.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, a friend of mine actually who lives in the States, who's Canadian, was visiting the GTA. And she told me just this weekend that she saw some ads, like pretty large billboards off the highway near Mississauga, where it had some questions. It's the one with the Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott on it, and basically saying how Trudeau like kicked them out, you know, like this is his anti-woman sort of stance or whatever. And so that ad, I'd only seen it, like pictures of it on Twitter, but apparently it is out there. And she was kind of taken aback to see, she goes, it was a really big billboard on the side of the highway. And she wasn't sure whose ad that was, but.
Well, and that's the other thing too, because you now have to identify who you are in both the pre-election and the election period. If you're a third party, you have to clearly identify who you are as a group. Now, there's all kinds of ways that people try to obfuscate that, obviously. You know, they'll come up with, you know, citizens for a better future kind of thing. And you really have to dig down. But the registry that Elections Canada now requires, you know, is supposed to give you names, not just of the people who are behind it, but, you know, but the people who are the donors. And so you are able to follow the money, which was one of the biggest problems before.
Yeah.
And in a timely way, too. It's not, you know, you used to have to wait until after the election was over and you have to, then everyone made their final reports to the reporting officer. Once you hit certain thresholds, you know, you have to make interim reports during the election period. So you know,
that's like real time information.
Fairly real time information about who's funding what. And when, you know, and when we talk about social media in during the election period as well, I mean, it's supposed to be same day registry for Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As well as all kinds of other metrics.
Like, I think they have to track. So it's on Facebook, I think Twitter. There's probably other things too, but
yeah.
where they are like anyone who's advertising has to track what they're spending, report it, and then it gets aggregated. And I am assuming that information is available publicly, right?
Yes. Yes. It's part of the public register. And it was interesting, you know, Facebook said, yeah, we'll comply. We'll give you detailed data. We're going to give you more data than is actually required by the legislation. So you can sort of massage the data yourself. So, you know, they said yes. And like I say, it's the same day registry. Twitter said it wasn't going to take any pre-writ ads. I'm not sure it was a time thing or they just were it's just too much trouble for them. And Google said it's not going to take any ads at all, whether it's pre-writ or post-writ. Although they have cautioned saying, you know, it's really difficult for us to keep track of all this stuff because all of it's automated. So a couple of them might slip through. But mm-hmm. Google just said, we're not going to play at all. And Google actually was in front of I think it was a Senate committee when the new legislation was coming through, and you know they complained that they hadn't been given adequate notice to of pending legislation and how it was going to affect them and how they can comply with it, and they face the same sort of a restriction in Washington State brought in similar kinds of transparency and real time reporting, and Google decided to opt out of those rules there as well. So, you know, this is becoming a bigger issue in Western democracies. And, you know, who's paying for what and, you know, how fast can we figure out who's behind what? Google is, their critics are saying that they're dragging their feet on it. They have billions and billions of dollars and, you know, literally tens of thousands of people working in analytics and programming. And, you know, they're just saying, you know, we don't want to do this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it definitely adds another dimension to their work, right? I mean, it's like anybody can get online these days and try to have an influence, as we know, right, with the bots and all that sort of thing. And it can come from anywhere, right? Because normally foreigners are not allowed to participate in our election. And, you know, that rule still stands. But when you've got the internet at your disposal, you just never know who's behind what. And so I think the government has done a decent job at trying to address some of the potential election interference kind of concerns and trying to give a bit more transparency. But it does have an impact on more than just the usual players, like companies that provide social media platforms and other, online type services are going to have to be involved. And I guess for them, you know, they do need some time to adjust, but I mean, they're also part of our social fabric, right?
Like, oh yeah, they've become such an incredibly important part of our political livelihood now. I mean, you can see that in the American elections, the effect that Google and Facebook has had. You know, there's a debate about whether they change any votes or if they just sort of polarize everyone and motivate them to go out and vote the way they were thinking in the first place. And, you know, that's best left for academics, but you know, the bottom line is they do have an effect, and you know, they do need to be regulated in order to make sure that you know elections are fair and transparent. And that's what Bill C-76 was supposed to do. It was supposed to, you know, make the financial reporting more transparent, the people behind the ads more transparent, and also to put limits on what money can buy you in an election.
Yeah. And I think in Canada, we're still better off than what they do in the States, where it's like insane amounts of money, right, that you need in order to be involved in the political process. Whereas here, at least, it's still, you know, there are some reasonable limits, I think.
Oh, yeah, we're still pretty small potatoes when it comes to actual money and spending. And that's why something like the per-vote subsidy it was such a hot button, because it was brought in 2004 by the Liberals. It was phased out in 2015 by the Harper Conservatives. And it used to pay, I think it was 44 cents every quarter to the political parties as a subsidy for every vote that they received in the previous general election. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you say 44.
I mean, that was good, I guess, for the smaller parties, right?
Like, oh, it was the party, you know, and I'll put on a little bit of a political analyst hat here and say, you know, it was phased out by the Conservatives because they consistently outfundraise everyone else in other means. So they don't need the money. They've got tons of money. They've always been great at money raising. They've studied, you know, the science of parting people from their money from some of the best people who've been doing it for decades in the United States, and they've brought that up here. So they don't need the per vote subsidy. The Liberals are always second in fundraising, never quite as much as the Conservatives. It's nice to have the per vote subsidy, but, you know, the Liberals were able to mostly replace it, I think. The NDP really was hurt by it because they're always, they're always last at the dance when it comes to these sorts of things, both in terms of seat representation and fundraising ability, especially since the law now doesn't allow unions or corporations to make donations to political parties. So when they cut off their union funding, and then they also cut off their per vote subsidy because they always got a decent popular vote, which translated into money in the bank for them. And they need, frankly, the NDP needed that money to continue to operate. I mean, they're in actually pretty poor financial shape right now.
They are, yeah.
And without a fundraising base, without unions being able to contribute, that, you know, that 44 cents every quarter meant an awful lot to them. So a cynic in me would say it was an attempt by the Conservatives to cripple the NDP. And, you know, the Liberals haven't brought it back either. They say that now that there's enough mechanisms in here for fundraising, they've raised limits and all the rest, that, you know, it sort of evens the playing field. But the amount of money, it was about $44 million a year that was distributed to the parties under the per vote subsidy. And the recent there's a recent question to member of the government, you know, whether or not they're considering bringing it back. There's actually a private member's bill to bring it back. Last year, which died on the order paper.
And do you know what party that private member was
from? It was a Liberal. It was a Liberal from Quebec, I believe. I think. Is it Boudria? Who was that? Michelle. I'll get the name wrong if I try.
But that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, my own view is I think it might make sense, like, to have that. Maybe not for the rich parties, right? The ones who can easily fundraise, but it does. I mean, it does sort of reduce the ability of other, you know, like we. It's good to have a healthy democracy, right? And have like different parties and. I don't know. I mean,
I think there's a vested interest in the government. I mean, using the big G word, you know, our whole system to encourage participation by genuine actors. And, you know, to pay, you know, $44 million is not a lot of money in the Canadian Treasury these days. It comes out of general revenue.
It isn't. That's right.
It's, you know, to pay that to ensure a healthy democracy. I mean, I'm in favor of a per vote subsidy. Here, I just looked it up. It was Private Bill C-364. Michel Boudrias, who I think is a Quebec Liberal MP, who brought it in.
Yeah.
And with a couple of other, it wasn't just that, it was a couple of other amendments, and I think it was sort of overtaken by the new amendments to the Elections Act that was brought in by the government.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in terms of, you know, the voting and some of the changes that have been brought in, I mean, one of the things that I thought was really good was how they've now expanded our ability to vote. So there are going to be more advanced polls. And the polls are going to be open for longer hours. They've also started putting in places where you can go and vote in post-secondary institutions. So in 2015, there were 39 places where you could vote on campus, whereas in 2019, they're predicting it's going to be around 115 places where you can go vote on campus. So I think that'll hopefully make it easier for those who are in university or college or whatever to exercise their vote. And I imagine that'll be good news for some of the more progressive parties, since that's where these younger people tend to be voting.
Yeah, and it's... you know, we've seen, unfortunately, in the United States, all kinds of attempts at various states, mostly Republican run, that, you know, that voter suppression is the way to win an election and get as few people out, or, you know, at least few of the other people out. And, you know, students are certainly, like you say, you look at the numbers, and you know they're not quite necessarily as progressive as people sometimes think, but generally they certainly skew that way. Mm. And it was certainly not in the interest of certain parties to make it easy for those people to vote, or make it easy for them to all vote in a place. Because, you know, if you're in at the University of Toronto and you've got 30,000 students all living within the riding of St. Paul's, or half in St. Paul's and half in, I guess it's Trinity Spadina, you know, that's a major block that can skew your election results. So, you know, if you require them to trek back to their home ridings, wherever they all come from, and vote mm-hmm. there, you know, it spreads it around, but it's, you know, what you end up doing is suppressing the vote.
Right. Right, exactly. And so anyway, but I think, you know, also like with people who are going to be newly able to vote, it's just good to encourage them, make it as easy as possible. And, you know, I think for most people, they who take this responsibility seriously, it doesn't matter where it is. And, you know, if it's a little bit of an inconvenience in your day, but for those who aren't used to voting, I think it's a good thing to just make it more easily available. But that kind of goes into the issue of, you know, from a voter's perspective, how does it all go? And, you know, one of the things that is also new this year, some changes in terms of when you go to your polling station, what kind of ID can you use? And there's actually a pretty wide range of things, like ways of identifying yourself, which I think are actually good. Like, I, you know, so one option is you just show one piece of ID, and this is something that will have your name and your address on it, and it has to be government issued. So, for example, your driver's license or any other card that's issued by the Canadian government that will have your photo, your name, and your current address. So that's pretty easy. So if you have a driver's license, that's probably the best bit of ID. That's all you need to take with you to go to your polling station on the day and or in one of the advance polls, and then you can vote. The other option, and I think this is the one I'm going to use, is you can show two pieces of ID. And on this, you just need to have your name and at least one of your one of the pieces has to have your current address on it. But then you do need to show two pieces of ID. And then there's a list on Elections Canada's website, which is elections.ca. And I'm going to tweet this out as well so people can have a look. But, you know, it's a pretty wide list of ID that you can choose from. So it could be anything that's like, you know, government issued. So it could be your birth certificate, your citizenship certificate, your passport, your health card, your income tax assessment, or from a financial institution. It could be a bank statement, a credit card statement. And from a private organization, it could be your employee card. And so there's a long, long list of
and that you can use. It's basically a combination. The way I always think about it is you have to prove who you are with preferably government ID and where you live, so that you're in the riding and that you're entitled to vote, and that you are actually the voter, you know, that you're not impersonating a voter.
Right.
So, yeah, and again, the Elections Canada website has a really great list of just all the stuff you need. And I've seen people, when I've worked in elections and polls, polling stations, people who've tried to vote with some of the craziest stuff. And you know, and if push comes to shove, the new Bill C-76 brought back the concept of vouching as well, which is...
Yeah, that's the third way. Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
So yeah. you can show up with someone who is entitled to vote in that same district, and they will basically say, yeah, I know this person, and they live in the district, and they're entitled to vote. And then, you know, if you don't have any ID at all.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that's actually good, because for different reasons, people may not have ID, you know, and like, for example, but one thing to point out, they will accept expired ID as long as it's still your current address. So like, let's say your driver's license is expired and you didn't, for whatever reason, get it renewed. You can use your expired one as long as it still represents your current address. And in terms of the vouching, someone can vouch for you, but that person can only vouch for one person unless you're talking about a long-term care residence,
which
makes
right.
sense. Because in places like that, you know, like people may not, like more of their residents may not actually have the right ID to vote. So I like the fact that there are different avenues that you can use to prove your identity in order for you to vote. So that's really important. The other thing to remember, if you know anybody who's Canadian, who has lived in Canada at some point in their life and lives overseas, they can still vote. Now, that wasn't the case previously, but the new rules that the Liberals changed said that, no, if you're living abroad, you can vote as a Canadian, as long as you at some point in your life have lived in Canada. The way you can sign up to vote from abroad is, you know, you apply online by mail or fax. Again, all this info is on elections.ca website. And then the riding that you're going to be voting in is based on where you last lived in Canada. And then they send you a voting kit. And so then that's how you'll do it if you're overseas. But if you're in Canada and for whatever reason on election day, you're not able to go in person and vote, you do have the opportunity to vote at advance polls. And these are also determined by, like the dates of these are also determined by the law. And once the writ drops, then, you know, those dates will become clear. But it's usually like in the 8 to 10 days or so before the actual election, where you can go in advance and vote, or you can vote by mail. For that, you will have to sign up in order to do that. So, you know, we don't have online voting yet, but we do have a few other ways in which people can vote. So hopefully people will, you know, make the effort. It's always important to vote. Doesn't matter what the polls say, right? I don't know.
So no. You always vote. I mean, I've voted, I think, in every single federal, provincial, municipal elections since I was of voting age, since I was 18. So that's a lot of elections. And it's so important. Like I say, you know, we've got a period of declining voter turnout, and even with Twitter and Facebook and, you know, the heated debates that go on in those places, there's sort of a general lack of a disconnectedness with the political process when it comes to actually picking your party. So what you're doing is you're seeding the ground to the people who are more organized, who are more motivated, who have very different interests from you. So it's important that you get out there and you know, whoever you vote for is it's important that your voice be heard.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. So thanks very much for joining me today. I mean, I think it was really good just to kind of go over some of the rules and everything. And the writ will drop any day now. So once that happens, it'll be interesting to see how the different campaigns unfold. As we said, it's important to make sure that you exercise your right to vote.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
You can't win if you don't have a ticket.
Absolutely. All right. Take care.
Thanks a lot.
Well, that was really great speaking with Stephen Lawtons about the elections. I think next week might be good for Professor S and I to dive into the election a bit more. Professor S, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that would be neat. What I would also throw out there is if anybody has a riding in mind that they think is particularly interesting, or if there are any potential candidates that they'd like us to look at, why don't you just, you know, contact us on Twitter and we'll take them up and we'll be happy to look at interesting ridings like that come to mind. I think that'd be a very good idea.
Sounds good. Okay, so let's move on to a media fail of the week and a political fail. Why don't you start with a media fail?
Okay, so for the media fail, we're going to hone in on two writers from Post Media, Anthony Fury and Brian Lilly of The Sun, respectively. And they are getting quite upset at the biases that they contend are being shown by their colleagues in the Canadian media in attacking Andrew Scheer. That may be or may not be true, but here's the thing. We're looking at an individual whose Twitter account and other utterings are quite out there and are blatantly not factual, or I'll say it, a lot of lies.
And by this
right?
individual, I mean, you're referring to who?
Andrew Scheer.
Okay.
Right.
Let's just
okay.
Play.
Sorry, I didn't mean to be so vague there. Okay, so they're upset, but if you take a look at what Andrew Scheer's Twitter account is churning out on an hourly basis, what you find are just a whole host of unrelenting lies. For example, the issue of Trudeau contemplating allowing the immigration to Canada of one of the murderers of James Bulger
in 1993.
We talked about that last week, but that's not true. Any understanding of basic immigration policy in this country and law would show you that he's not Canadian. He can't come here based on that.
Last I checked, that's still up. They didn't take it down. They haven't retracted it.
No, they have not retracted it. So my media fail is the following. Yes, members of the media having a particular bias against a particular politician is disingenuous. But this is even more disingenuous because they are propping up lies and then crying wolf when others are attacking Andrew Scheer for the lies. So that's my fail of the week. If you want to be impartial or informative or balanced.
Well, isn't that
goodness
the point of
me?
Journalists? Like, isn't that what they're supposed to be doing? Like, I think this other thing is more a propagandist, right? Like someone who's just going to try to prop up someone who doesn't deserve it. Like, that is not what a journalist should be doing. A journalist is supposed to be providing objective analysis, and they can have opinions, like if you get a columnist, for example, or something like that. But
sure. But
the opinions still have to be based in fact, right, and not be politically motivated. So,
calling Andrew Scheer a liar is a fact based on many of his tweets. It's not a problem for somebody to say he's lying because there are many examples of where he's lying.
Yeah,
so
yeah, exactly.
I would just say, you know what, just get over it and just grow up. And
Good fail. So mine is rather bizarre. NDP was quite upset at the Green Party because the Green Party came out with this announcement that 15 NDP candidates were jumping ship to the Greens in New Brunswick. And then it turns out, less than a day later, we find out, no, actually, not all of them were. So then you get this second announcement with the NDP saying, actually, that's not true. And then we're just like, wow, that story has just completely gotten super, interesting here. And so then in the end, the Green Party did have to apologize. Apparently there were five MP or NDPers who shouldn't have been on that list. And allegedly, the Green Party saying, well, they misunderstood what this declaration of support that we wanted them to sign was all about. And I don't know what the deal is, but all I know is that that was kind of a political fail, both for the Greens and the NDPers who were involved, because you know, it just shows there's some disorganization, that there's like, that there's not a coherent group there that, you know, is part of this national campaign. And it doesn't speak well for the Greens or the NDP. And then to make it even worse, one of the guys who defected from the NDP, Jonathan Richardson, and he's a former federal NDP executive member. He said, allegedly, according to the CBC News, that racism was one of the reasons for the party's lack of success in finding candidates with an election call imminent. And by that, he's alluding to the fact that the leader of the NDP, Jagmeet Singh, is a visible member of the Sikh community, and that may have something to do with it. And that too is kind of a fail, because, you know, when you're a progressive party, those are not the kinds of things you should be worried about, you know, like you should be, and the NDP generally is pretty strong in terms of calling out racism, and especially under Jagmeet Singh, like he has been pretty vocal about things that, you know, go to minority issues and so on. And so what it made me think of was, the Green Party is just a bit confused, it seems, you know, like they're trying to...
Well, I think both parties are a bit confused.
I think so. But I guess I was just starting with the Greens just to say that, you know, they've had a few missteps in the last little while. I generally have liked Elizabeth May, but there are certain things, certain judgment calls over the last little while that just make me wonder, you know, is the party really at a point where they can credibly, grow themselves in at the federal level? I kind of do want more Green MPs to be elected. Personally, I think it would be good for the discourse at the at Parliament. But in terms of just how the party is right now, I just think it's not really. I mean, they're not showing themselves to be very sophisticated right now. And the NDP, I mean, I feel kind of badly for them in that I think they're imploding. I think there's a lot of disharmony within the party, and
You know, I hope that they'll be able to turn this around. I don't think the election will go very well for them, but I guess we'll see as we track things over the next few weeks.
Well, on the Greens' electoral successes, we should also bear in mind that there is an election process going on in Manitoba right now, so that can be also an indicator to see how the Greens do there and whether or not they can use that momentum, like they were trying to do with one of the elections out in the eastern Canada, to see if they can use that election to galvanize votes across the country. So all is not lost, but for the NDP especially, it seems not very good in terms of electoral success at this stage.
I would
humbly submit.
Yeah. So I would say this is sort of a joint fail on the part of the NDP and the Greens for this week anyways. All right. So those are the...
There's always next week.
Yeah. So those are the fails. Do you have any fact or fictions?
I do. I have fact or fictions related to your conversation with Stephen in terms of electoral concerns and the like. So in Canada, in the last federal election, there was Prime Minister Trudeau ran on the platform of electoral reform, right? That was one of the key components. And we all know what happened with that. But I want to draw your attention to another Westminster-style country that has gone through some levels of reform. So fact or fiction? The term of New Zealand's parliament is set at 3 years.
I have no idea, so I'm just going to go with fact.
It is a fact. It is set at 3 years. Now, why did I bring that up?
And is that a new thing?
Not really. Okay. No, okay. I've got some history for you in this. The reason why I brought this one up is we've already had like pre-election cycle campaigning, right? Because the Fixed Elections Act in Canada, where, you know, parties are ramping up for an election even before a writ has been called, whereas before they'd be waiting and seeing when is the Prime Minister going to drop the writ for an election. Now with our fixed term in the political act, the fixed term, we're seeing a lot of different types of behavior that we didn't see in previous years. They changed in 1993. This change in
so
the
I'm
electoral
assuming
they
system went from where something they higher to 3 years.
They did. It was similar to what we have right now, but they capped it at three. But based on that, I also then have a second fact or fiction on the New Zealand experience, just to wrap this one up. Fact or fiction, New Zealand turned from first past the post to a mixed member proportional representation system following the results of a referendum in 1993.
Fact.
True. You're 100% correct. So New Zealand had a national referendum in 1993 in which, I don't have it off the top of my head, my apologies for that, but voters voted in favor of changing the electoral system to a variant of proportional representation. And just to update this, the use of the system was reviewed again by referendum in November 2011, I beg your pardon, and the majority, 56.17%, voted to keep it in place.
That's interesting. That's a majority, but it's not like a big majority. Which
it's not overwhelming at all.
Which I find when it comes to referendums, my own personal view is that, one, they're bad ways to make big changes in policies, but if you did want to take the temperature of a population, that the threshold needs to be higher than that in order to make big change. That's my own view, but we can talk about referendums another time. But okay.
Yeah, I wish they'd done that with Brexit, but nonetheless.
Yes, they should have done that with Brexit, because the UK is definitely going to be paying for a very long time. And actually, maybe one day we'll do Brexit as a topic, maybe after the election.
Oh, wonderful.
That would be a good one. I have some views on that one. As I'm sure you do, right, too, as someone from the UK.
I do.
So, originally. Anyway, so thanks. That was a very good and relevant comparative fact or fiction. And we'll wrap it for this week. Next time on Matter of Fact, we'll continue talking about the elections, but we'll zero in on some ridings. So do let us know if there are any in particular that you're interested in. You can tweet at me at @Ishat_Reza. Or use the hashtag #AskIReza. In the meantime, have a good week, and we'll see you next time.
This is fun! The FU Network!